accession number 29536, Mr. Bert Scriven, row 13. Now, what happened when you got to the Garigliano area?
There I heard that our battalion were to cross it. Using boats, I think. For some reason, I was not involved in that at all. I seem to have been shunted off in a different direction. But it was a successful crossing. And then we were heading for what we called Monastery Hill at that stage, in the Monte Cassino area. Now, whether it was actually Monte Cassino itself, or a hill that was later known as Monastery Hill, which was much, much taller, I don't know. But we were, our section was shunted off into the Apennines to Mount Monte Camino. We were camped for a few days at the base of it, and then one night we were told we were going forward into the hills, and it would be eventually Monte Camino. Unfortunately, the Germans, there was a track ran up to the top of the hill, but the German, a track is a road, the Germans had tried to blow it up. They'd partially succeeded and taken half of the road out on the valley side with a drop of several hundred feet. It was passable by lorry, by day, carefully, but we had to go up at night. So the instructions were that we would go as far as the road was blown. Then the vehicle commander would light a cigarette, get out of the lorry, walk past the blown road in the centre of the road, which just gave a three-ton lorry width, holding the glowing end of his cigarette over his shoulder, and the lorry driver would then drive his lorry behind him with the lighted cigarette glow in the centre of his bonnet. It was hairy, to say the very least. However, when it came to my turn, I did as I was told. And we did get round there, all right. In fact, I don't remember anybody going down the side of the mountain. Incidentally, during this, I never refer normally to mountains. I got used to the Indian Army method of calling all heights hills, and we all did the same thing. Everything to us was a hill. Didn't matter how high it was still a hill. Anyway, we got up to the top, and our section of transport was directed at a road junction off to the right into a very lightly wooded area, which was very much downhill.
So that was going to be a B echelon.
And that's where we were going to be B echelon. We didn't realise how slippery it was and so on, but it was coated with liquid mud, and very carefully the drivers drove down.
Do you know what month this is? Is this November by now?
It must be November. It was raining like hell. The terrain was mud and nothing but, and each driver very carefully tried to bring his lorry butting up against a tree to save its sliding. In fact, the only way we got out of there was using block and tackle and trees and manually hauling them out of the lagering area. It was cold, it was wet, and it was the only time that I had the winter issue of underwear on my body. I would always avoid long johns and woolen vests. They were most uncomfortable to wear, and I always wore the summer cellular drawers and so on. But this time I was wet to the skin, and everything I possessed was wet except the winter underwear, which I put on for one day, as I remember, until I could get things dry. From there, we had, of course, to go down every day to reach base, brigade, division, wherever. And that blown-out piece of road was no picnic, even in daylight, even downhill, and with a very good driver. But we stayed up there for a few weeks, I think.
Now, what was going on up there?
Across the valley, on the next set of hills, were the infantry. And part of my job then, I went down into the valley with ammunition, where we had a base to provide the blokes up on the hills with rations and so on. It was sheer mountain, to describe it, nothing but rock. There was no way of digging slit trenches. They had to build sangers, as we called them, rock shelters. Put a rock wall in front of yourself, try and get over and under an overhang or whatever. But that's the only protection they had. They were rationed to a pint of water a day, forbidden to wash or shave. Everything had to be manhandled. You couldn't even get mules up there. And if you remember, I'd had mule packing training, but it was no use. We couldn't get them up there. So it was man packed up. For that, we had African native bearers. They went up in single file and with some infantry alongside to so-called guard them, whether it was to stop them running away, which I don't think they would, or to guard them against attack, I don't know, but they had a few up there. And as the request came down, so I put out man loads of ammunition for them. And of course they all had to carry water up and food. Water they carried, 2 jerry cans. That's 8 gallons of water, which is 80 pounds weight, and that's one hell of a weight to carry. But they did it. After a few days of that, I began to feel uneasy that I was just sitting at the base, putting out loads and so on, and sending indents back for more ammunition. And decided the transport officer was in charge of that little camp. And I said to him, I feel like I ought to go up there and have a look and see what's happening. And I'll act as one of the guards and pick something up with me, you know. He said, you don't have to do that. And I said, well, I feel I ought to. So I did. It was not a pleasant experience, I have to say that. And how those poor bearers put up with it, I don't know. They did, with a grin quite often. But they were tough boys, they really were. And I did go up there. Terrible. The men were scattered all over the place with their little sangers, as they could. They were under constant fire from where, I don't know. But they were. The hardship, obviously, it was raining, it was winter, it was cold. They had nothing much. Well, they had Mutafuel tablets, if they could make tea, and that was, of course, the only fuel allowed. They lived on cold rations, as far as I could see, most of the time. Very little to drink. Really miserable conditions, really miserable. I'm not sure how long they were up there, because I was withdrawn after my expedition up. A couple of days later, I was withdrawn to B Echelon again. I don't know why. I was just withdrawn. And nobody seemed to go up and take my place, so perhaps the transport officer stayed there and looked after it. And I stayed at... by that time, B Echelon had moved to another area with buildings. And so I was able to...
A farm or a village?
Isolated buildings somewhere. The edge of a village, I rather think. And I stayed there for a while. Then, what happened? Then we moved on forward again. We must have used Highway 6, Route 6, which was on the coastal side of the Leary Valley, and went up towards Naples again.
Or moved back?
Forward, sort of. No, it must have been back. So it was... No, it must have gone forward. Or sideways, maybe.
Naples is...
Yeah, it's a fair way, but yes, it is.
Long way back.
That's right. No, we must have gone cross-country and back towards the coast, because the next thing... yes, we did. We went into another section of line further towards the sea. That I remember, and we took over a small town there. There was an incident there. I was in charge. It was B Echelon, and I had guard duty one night, guard commander, and we had a strict curfew for the natives in town, the Italians. And one of the guard came back to me about 4 o'clock in the morning, and said, "I don't know what to do, Corp. We've arrested a girl who insists on going forward along the main road towards the Germans. We've turned her back twice and she's still trying to go." So I said, "Well, all you can do is bring her in." And we were in the town square at that stage.
You don't know which town?
Can't remember the name of the town. But it had a chief of police there and the police headquarters for an area about as big as Kent, as far as I can see. And I had spoken to him a couple of times, trying out my Italian, which was almost non-existent. But he could speak English. And I said, well, bring her back. I said, she got any English? She said, no. So when she came back, I tried. I couldn't get any sense out of her. So I went over to the police headquarters and belted on the door. And eventually somebody answered and said that the chief of police, Commandante, lived in the palazzo, the big building, next to the square, one building down. So I hammered on that until they answered. And then a mixture of English, what little schoolboy French I had, and what Italian, all five words I expect, I had, I demanded to see the chief of police. And he eventually came. By that time it was six-ish, I suppose. And I said I'd got a girl here that kept on breaking curfew, kept going forward to where the Germans were. He said, what do you want me to do about it? Lock her up? I said, I want to know why she's doing it. And so we walked across to his headquarters with the girl. And he kept on wanting to put her in jail. And I said, no, I don't want her in jail. I want to know why she's going forward and where she's going. So he eventually questioned her and found that she was a servant girl, a true peasant, if one uses that phrase. And she was going to a farm to get milk. And she didn't dare go home without it, go back. So he said, well, shall I throw her in jail now? I said, no. Who sent her? And who does she work for? And she worked for a local lawyer, notary, as they call him. And I said, well, I want to see him. Because I was getting fed up with the fact that the girl was being sent somewhere where she shouldn't be. And she was frightened not to do what she was told. So he was rousted out. And I asked him why the girl was going forward. And he said, well, got to get our milk for our breakfast. I said, she's not allowed out. There's a curfew. Oh, that doesn't apply to her. I said, oh, yes, it does. It applies to you too. Oh, we don't go out. We send her out. This was the sort of conversation we were having. And eventually, the chief of police said, well, what should we do? Just throw her in jail? I said, no, I said, throw him in jail. Meaning the lawyer, the employer, that is. So throw him in jail because he's sending a girl somewhere she shouldn't go. And she's scared to death. And they thought that was maybe a very wise decision. They didn't fancy it very much. And eventually I gave him a warning. I said he's never to do it again. And he'd go home. And the girl would go home and she was not going to get milk. And that's that. So they went home and I could have been Solomon then. Because they all thought I was fantastic, you know. Oh, very British and very fair-minded and so on. And then they asked the urgent question that had been plaguing them all the time. Was I, of course, a Catholic? And I said, no, I'm a Protestant. And they all recoiled. I could have got cloven hoofs and horns and all the rest of it then. A Protestant? They'd never met one. And how does a Protestant behave like that? They're evil. And so on. Anyway, it was a base of quite a good friendship we had. And we weren't bothered again. Except by the dear ladies who were driving mobile canteens. Church Army, NAFI, VS, I think, various organisations, all usually had two middle-aged ears who drove the lorries, or vans, made tea, and supplied us with mostly rock cakes, I guess, which we uncharitably called wads. And their big difficulty was them, was that they would just go keep on driving forward and forward and forward, never thinking where they were going, just that they'd got to get tea and wads up to the lads in the front. And we had a lot of difficulty with them trying to stop them or turn them back. They were heroines, those women. They really were. I had a lot of time for them. They just kept on and on going forward. You find them all over the place. And it was at that time that I was doing a recce, trying to find out where some of our troops were, that I got stuck between lines. I'd gone too far, and I was on foot, fortunately. And I'd gone too far, and I found that I was in front of our blokes.
In number,
sort of. I mean, it was very confused fronts. There were no no man's land as such as one would have in warfare, trench warfare. It was just a confused area where you suddenly realise that you're in front of your forward troops. That was difficult because it could be that the general password I'd been given could be for our section or battalion only, and it wouldn't be recognised by anybody else. And I had to think hard about that. I can't just blindly walk back into our lines, and I certainly couldn't go the other way. And I didn't want to stand up anyway too much when I discovered that position, because Germans could see me just as much as I could, I expect. I don't know that for sure, I just expected. Then I remembered a tradition. Every infantry unit, when they're on a route march, sings a series of songs, always, strangely enough, in a certain order. They sing a song which follows by another song which is followed by another song, usually very ribald and absolutely obscene on occasion. And I thought, oh, there's only one thing. So I started hoping that I was still on our battalion's territory. So I started singing a series of songs quite quietly. I must admit, I wasn't bellowing out, but I was doing it very, very quietly, and crawling forward at the same time, and hoping to God somebody could recognise what I was singing. And someone did. And he said, "Who's that out there?" I said, "Oh, Bert Scrivens, if it's any help, if you know me." "Oh, are you the bloke with the ammo?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What the bloody hell are you doing out there then?" I said, "I don't know, but I found myself there." So we said, "Well, come on in." And I crawled into his slit trench, and he pointed me in the general direction of company headquarters, and so I went back again. Very hairy position, that. And I must admit it rattled me somewhat. But still, that was that. Then, what would that be? Christmas time.
You're still in the line.
I'm still, well, we're still based in the same little town, still with ammunition and other duties as they occurred, you know, sort of jack of all trades, really. We had a Christmas there.
Any celebrations you manage?
Don't remember any. Not at all. Just a moment, I'm just trying to think. Christmas time, that would be 3, wouldn't it? Hmm. 4. That was the Anzio bit. No, I think we just moved around. Oh, yes, of course. Because we were in the line at Christmas, and we had to celebrate Christmas afterwards, when we got out again, when we were sent back to rest in January sometime, at which time the quartermaster said, what he got on? I said, well, they're at rest, so, you know, nothing much. I'm up to date. Everything's there. He said, would you like to go out foraging or buying some goodies for the troops to have their Christmas? Stuff to eat, drink, whatever. I'll give you some funds. I said, well, it would be better if you gave me things like boots and blankets. But I did manage to get some. He said, go back and see what you can do. So I said, all right. He said, take about a week. He said, I don't think it'll be easy to find. He said, but if you can get some poultry or something, they'd appreciate it. So I couldn't think where to go, and then I suddenly thought of this chief of police that was around. So I went to see him. And he said, oh, yes, he said, I can do that. He said, I'll introduce you to the black market. He said, you can see all the blokes in the black market and buy what you want. So he took me across the town square into some barns and stables and things, and there was heaps and heaps of farm produce all over the place. And I said, well, I want some geese or something. I said, but they'll have to be live because we don't know when we can use them. So eventually I stayed with him a couple of days, and he introduced me to all the black marketeers, and we did some bargaining with one thing and another, or money, or whatever. And I ate with him. Still the feudal fashion there, where the men eat and the women serve them, and they eat what the men leave. And eventually I loaded up the van I was in, and we went back with, I don't know, a dozen live geese, and lots of other odds and ends. I'd had a list from the cooks, and when they say they want cornflour, you know, I had to try and figure out what cornflour was in the first place and how he got at it. But it was pretty successful. But of course, having live poultry floating around, even if we were at rest, we had to appoint somebody to look after the geese, which they did. And then, of course, to slaughter and butcher them. The battalion butcher did the butchering. The slaughtering, I don't know who they found, but they found somebody. Because geese are not easy to kill, one way or another.
So it was a delay. It was a Christmas in January, so.
Well, our Christmas was in January, yeah.
Now, the next thing is. Is this Anzio business?
No. Anzio.
How did that happen? What is next? You're out at rest.
Well, back into the line, off and on, and so on. Now, Anzio was 44, wasn't it?
January 44.
Yes, we switched back and forth, it seemed, with the Adriatic side, but mostly it was slogging uphills, downhills, uphills, downhills, in between complete confusion to me.